equations here. So let me look at the field equations. And as usual, we're not going to worry about factors of two. If I vary the S by the frame field, then I have a term, two terms from here which are identical, and four terms from here which are identical. And so I get the epsilon ABCD stays there. These epsilons, let me emphasize, are just plus ones and minus ones. They're totally antisymmetric, and epsilon 0, 1, 2, 3 is plus 1. And so I have EB wedge F. This was supposed to be downstairs. AB, CD, EB wedge F, CD, still a function of A, minus lambda, and there's an overall, there are four of those and two of these, so there's a two there, EB wedge EC wedge ED, all of that equal to zero. So that doesn't look yet much like the Einstein equation, but that's what we have. And then delta S, delta A. And what we have to do is take the variation here and integrate by parts. So let me, just because this is the kind of thing we're going to have to do many times, this is epsilon ABCD EA wedge EB wedge, and inside the F is a del A C D, and we have the variation there. And then we have inside the F the pair of the A's. And so we have a factor of two delta A C E wedge A E D. And if we're in form notation, this is a D. All right, so I'm just looking at the field equations of this action we call the Palatini action. One now integrates by parts. It's a thing that, again, all of these are equations you should check, that the covariant derivative comes along in the integration by parts. So this becomes minus integral epsilon ABCD of the covariant derivative of EA wedge EB times delta ACD. So the equation that one has, and then to write out what this means, the equation that one has is therefore the covariant derivative of EA wedge EB is equal to zero. If I write this out, this is the ordinary derivative. So let me give everybody some indices. Mu nu alpha, and there's an overall epsilon mu nu alpha beta. So what I've done here is I've just put back the space-time indices, and since this is a differential form, it's antisymmetric. So this is epsilon mu nu alpha beta times the derivative mu of e nu a e alpha b. And there's an anti-symmetrization in nu and alpha, so it's implicit in A and B, plus A mu E nu, A nu A E, E nu E, E alpha B, plus another term where the A acts on the B. And all of that is equal to zero. Now, you can find details of the following in the appendix of Wald or in Misnethar and Wheeler or many other places. Using the inverse relations for the frame fields and their duals, one can make this an equation of the form of A is equal to something which looks like E inverse derivatives of E plus a bunch of terms like that. But each term has an E inverse, a derivative, and an E in it. And this tells you that the A's are really functions of E's and their derivatives. And it's some algebra, which I'm not going to do, to invert this and express the A's in the forms of E inverses and derivatives of E's. And I suggest that that's a good check to do. One then takes these A's and plugs them into here. And the result, so if you plug in A of E, the result is an equation which I'll call G. Now it has free indices A, and it has one free index alpha equals 0, where G A alpha is E A mu of the Einstein tensor mu alpha equals 0, where finally, and I apologize, this is such boring stuff because these are so many definitions, where G mu nu is R mu nu minus 1/2 G mu nu R. So in other words, the equations that you get by varying the frame fields, which have one Lorentz index and one spacetime index, or in other words, it's a one form valued in the spacetime index, I'm sorry, in the Lorentz index, are, when you correct for the indices, the same as Einstein's equations when you plug in the solution for the Yang-Mills fields A as a function of the frame fields and their derivatives that you get by varying the action by the frame fields. So when you're all done, this is Einstein's theory. And I apologize for all the details, and I also apologize leaving you to do most of the checks. If we went through every step here, that would be all that we would do for the next hour. It's a lot of steps to check, but the moral of the story is that this action has a space of solutions which are the same up to something I'll mention in a minute. They're almost the same set of solutions as the solutions of the Einstein equation. Yes.
But basically, then the E's are kind of just auxiliary fields, so they are not really degrees of freedom, because I mean the equation of motion doesn't contain a derivative in E's. So then the actual statement in the beginning that there are more degrees of freedom is not correct, because you can exactly solve for these.
Well, no, you solve for the A's. The A's.
Well, yeah, but that's the technical
step. Okay, so for the E's, because there are no derivatives of E's in that equation of motion.
What are you pointing at? You're pointing at this.
Yeah.
No, but you cannot invert this to find E as a function of A.
At least I don't think you can invert this to find E as a function of A. I've never seen that. And if you can do that, I'm going to do something later on which is about as cool, but is not precisely the same thing as inverting E. I'm going to invert another object and express that other object as a function of E, but not the E. Keep with me, because there's some very cool stuff like that coming. But I have never seen somebody write down the E's as some explicit function of the A's in their derivatives. In fact, it's what's the reverse. The A's are an explicit function of the E's in their derivative. Okay. Now, notice one thing. I said there is one issue. In order to write this form and solve for A as a function of derivatives of E, the derivatives of E here, I have to multiply here times two E inverses. I have to use the duality between E and its inverse here. So by the inverse, let me make sure that it's clear. The E's are a basis for the space of one forms on the manifold. The E inverses, or the E duals, are the basis for the space of vector fields. I have to get this, explicitly invoke E inverse. Now, notice that the action is polynomial in the E. And because the action is polynomial in the E's, the equations of motion that I get do not imply that E has an inverse. That is, the determinant of E, say mu A, which if you work it out is the square root of the determinant of G, because determinants of the product is the product of the determinant, might be zero. If I want this to be not zero, I need to impose it. Now, in the Einstein action, I use it all over the place. The very expression for the Christoffel symbols inside the curvature tensor involves the metric and its inverse. This is something, the Christoffel symbols are of the form G inverse mu nu G nu lambda derivative mu. I'm even reverting to an old notation, you know, I learned 100 years ago, is to get the Christoffel symbols. So the Einstein equations are written in a form that requires that the determinant of the metric be non-zero. Otherwise, the Einstein equations don't make any sense. Their field equations don't make any sense. The Palatini action does not imply or necessarily assume that the determinant of the metric is zero. The determinant of the metric, therefore, could be zero. That is, there are solutions to these equations and these equations where the determinant of E or the determinant of the metric are zero. And that sector of solutions, which is a degenerate sector, so in other words, there exists a degenerate sector, solutions where the determinant of E is equal to zero, and those have no counterpart in the solutions of the Einstein equations. So if you like, in the space of solutions of the Einstein equations, there's a boundary that you can append, which is the determinant of E equals zero. And you can go to the boundary, and the determinant of E could be zero on a point, on a line, on a surface, on a three manifold, everywhere, et cetera. So there's a whole set of degenerate solutions of the Palatini equations, which are sitting on a kind of boundary of the solutions of the Einstein equations. And I just point that out to show that they're not completely equivalent.
Yeah. Volume to be zero?
The volume, if it's true over a region, it means the volume of that region is zero. Because the volume of a region is the integral over the determinant of the square root of the determinant of the metric.
It just happened at a point?
It means that the determinant of the metric is zero at the point. Yeah.
Can you just say that you have a singularity for the Einstein? the solutions are
there. They're not singularities of the kind that are usually described. They're not places where the curvature goes up.
But it's still.
There are places where where the inversion of A as a function of E breaks down. Now, there hasn't been much studied.
And I know of no claim for, you know, for their physical significance in the real world. But it's important to point out, because this is either a feature or a bug, and it remains in all the things that I'll be talking about. So I wanted to point it out. And it's a direct consequence of the action being polynomial. As soon as the action is polynomial in the frame field, then you have this possibility coming up. Okay, now, and I just want to emphasize that because many good things do happen as a result of the action being polynomial. Okay. More questions? Okay. So now I'm going to, I told you that the Palatini was the first step. Now we're going to take some more steps. And there are some very beautiful, there's some very beautiful geometry associated with what I'm about to do next. And I'm afraid I'm going to give it short shrift for this treatment. But if people want, after we've seen the basics, I can mention it. Okay. Now, we need some notation, and we need to introduce some structures which have to do with properties which are called self-duality. So let me, for the moment, I'm just going to be interested in Lorentzian tensors. So object of the form of MAB, which are two index Lorentzian tensors, which are anti-symmetric, so the minus MBA. And there's just some beautiful properties associated with these. Why they're of interest is because the generators of the Lorentz group are anti-symmetric, and therefore the A's are anti-symmetric in their Lorentz indices, and the F's are anti-symmetric. So the things that I'm about to do, one can do to the A's and to the F's. Okay? Now, we have the totally anti-symmetric tensor epsilon, and we have the metric. So it's possible to define what's called the dual of such a tensor, which is defined to be, so three lines means defined, a half epsilon AB CD MCD. And notice that this involves the anti-symmetric symbol, and it involves the metric because I lowered the indices here. Okay, so this is called the dual of an anti-symmetric tensor. And one, it's an operation. If one wants to be formal, this is a math. In other words, let what I need a name. We've already used script M. Let me use M with a line under it for the space of these tensors. And so then what this really means is there's a map called star from the space to itself. And this map has the property that its square brings it back to itself, but actually with a minus sign for the Lorentzian case. I take M is the space of such anti-symmetric two-index tensor in special relativity. Okay, so that's what I call M with a line under it. Yes?
In a what?
By using the square root g for the u.
No, there's no square root g. So this is just, this is not on a manifold. This is in, there's a vector space of anti-symmetric tensors. So this is just a vector space. It's not on a manifold. So given the epsilon and the metric, there's this duality map from the space of anti-symmetric tensors to itself. Okay. Its square is minus 1 in the Lorentzian case. That is, you can check epsilon A, B, C, D, epsilon C, D, E, F is minus because of the Lorentzian indices, delta A, B, delta, sorry, A, E, delta B, F, anti-symmetrizer with a 2 there. And it's plus 1 for the Euclidean case. Where the metric has Euclidean signature. One can look for objects where, which have the property that star on it is equal to himself. We can look for eigen, it is proportional to himself, so we can look for eigenvectors. Okay. Because the square is minus 1, the eigenvalues have to be plus or minus I. So we can look for objects where S, an anti-symmetric tensor with this map on it, gives plus or minus I times it back. And let me put the full indices on it. And you can easily see that a way to construct such an SAB is to take any anti-symmetric tensor and add plus I times its dual with a 1/2, if I have done it right. I think I don't need the 1/2.
Yeah.
It's linear. Okay. And all the I's around, I'm not going to keep saying this, but all the I's here will go away in the Euclidean case. Okay. Now, just to be completely explicit, and the notation that's often used for this is to call this M plus AB. And if I put a minus sign here, so it corresponds to the minus, we'll put a minus. So given any anti-symmetric tensor, we speak of, and these things have names, we speak of the self-dual and anti-self-dual parts. Or anti-self-dual. Okay, now, suppose these are the generators of the Lorentz group. Okay, that is, the Lorentz tensors lambda, which are orthogonal, the lambda inverse is lambda transpose, can be expressed as E to some generators which are symmetric. Do I have that right? Sorry, anti-symmetric. Ah! That was everything that one says here is being recorded. Sorry, anti-symmetric. So there are 6 degrees of freedom here, and there are 6 4x4 anti-symmetric tensors.
Sorry, what does the implication symbol mean here?
It means this any lambda is the exponential of an antisymmetric tensor. Thank you. Now, if I now, let me now give names to these indices, 0, I, where I is 1, 2, 3, then the Aij generate an SO3 subgroup of SO3 of SO13. So that's the rotations that fix the time axis, that is spatial rotations. And there's so much that we're doing here, which is just notation, so forgive me. So those are the generators of rotations. And the A0i generate boosts then. That is, they live in the part of the Lorentz group which is not rotations. And they generate boosts along the ith axis in space-time. Okay. Now let's ask what an A plus does. An A plus has indices, say, 0i, which are A0i plus I times epsilon ijk ajk. That is, what this is a linear combination of a boost in the ith direction and I, the square root of minus 1, times a rotation around that axis. And with the minus sign, it's the same thing with the minus sign there.
Small rotations.
These are generating. Yes, I'm right. These are the generators. So these are anti. The generators, good question. These are anti-symmetric matrices, which are the generators. Okay. And since it's an eigenvector of the self-dual operation, you know, anything A 0i is in fact the same thing as the dual operator on it times I. So it's I, it's minus I times ajk for the plus value. So I only have to give the 0i because then the jk is given by the fact that it's self-dual. In other words, by the fact that these objects, any object which is self-dual satisfies SJK is epsilon IJK S0I with the I lowered times plus or minus I is one of these objects, self-dual or anti-self-dual. Okay. So that means that out of the six anti-symmetric matrices which generate the Lorentz transformations, there are three of them which are self-dual and three of them which are anti-self-dual. And the algebra is interesting. The algebra is that all the self-dual guys commute with all the anti-self-dual guys. And the self-dual guys, of which there are three distinct ones, give us another SO3. And so do the minus ones. Because you can check that the self-dual generator commuted with the self-dual generator is I times the self-dual generator and so forth. So you have three objects which close under commutators, so they therefore form a Lie algebra, and there's only one Lie algebra with three guys. Okay. So what is happening is that SO13 as a Lie algebra is the sum of an SO3, which we can call plus, plus an SO3, which we can call minus. And it's actually natural. Look, if you think about this, here's an axis. With the plus sign, the object is a boost of a certain amount in that direction, plus I times a rotation in that direction with a positive sense. And the other one is the same thing with the rotation with a negative sense. So we call this plus one, we also call this left-handed to indicate that that would give the sense. And we call this right-handed. And in fact, a parity operation, which reflects space through a parity operation so that all the spatial axes go to their minus axes, exchanges these two. So it's natural to call these left-handed and to call these right-handed. So this is some interesting facts about the Lorentz group in 3 plus 1 dimensions, which are coded into the structure of the self-dual and anti-self-dual sub-algebras of the Lorentz algebra. Yeah.
Well, you're blurring a bit whether it's really
SO3
or
SLTC.
It's really
SLTC. I am blurring that, yes, you're right. You're right.
Is that going to matter for anything later?
Yes. Thank you for pointing that out. Yes. So let me, so had we been doing the Euclidean case where there were no I's, what I just said was honest. Okay. What has actually happened because of the presence of the I's everywhere
is that, and you're quite right, is that this is really SL2C, and this is really another version of SL. No, I'm sorry. This is really SU2. Here's what you want to say, okay, and I'm going to insist on it my way. Okay, as Lie algebras, as soon as I write this, I really have a Lie algebra over the complexes. And as a Lie algebra over the complexes, you could see it as SL2C with over the reals, or as SO3 over the complexes. So it has three generators but complex coefficients. Yes. Yes. And that's the way I want to see it. I was hoping not to have to say it, but you're quite right. I have to say it. The reality structure in the Lorentzian case is that given an object A, you get the objects which is real, A plus and A minus. You get from them A plus and A minus. And A being real, so I'm referring to complex conjugation by a bar because we already have a star. A is real if and only if the complex conjugate of A plus is A minus. Therefore, this guy is an SU2 over the complexes, but you don't have two SU2s over the complexes because every generator here is the complex conjugate of a generator here. So you still always have six real dimensions in SO31 described as three complex guys plus their complex conjugates. Is that, I think that what I just said was honest. Okay. Now, if I was, well, whatever, if I wanted to avoid the complexity, I would have just done the Euclidean case first. But since space-time is Lorentzian and this is a course about time, I thought I should keep everything in front of you. Okay. Now, therefore, I want to keep the Palatini theory up there. Let me now come to the gauge theory of the Lorentz algebra. So I'm now going to apply everything that I've been doing to the local Lorentz tensors that we've been discussing. So now AB, the connection or the gauge field, splits into an A plus AB and an A minus AB. And they are the complex conjugates of each other. And as matrices, they commute with each other. Therefore, FAB splits into FAB plus FAB minus. Okay. Notice if I take the self-dual plus the anti-self-dual part of an anti-symmetric tensor and add them, I get back the original tensor. So I can take the tensor FAB and write it as FAB plus and FAB minus. And FAB plus is DA plus AB plus the commutator of A plus with A plus. So I can write it as A plus AC wedge A plus CB, like that. So it's just a function of A plus, and indeed it lives in the part of that S complexified SO3 that just A plus lives in. Okay. And similarly, so this is just F plus, this is just a function of A plus, and similarly F minus is just a function of A minus. So there's a splitting of the field strengths or curvatures into a plus piece, which we call the self-dual piece, and a minus piece, which we call the anti-self-dual piece. Therefore, the Palatini action splits. So the action due to Palatini splits into a term which is E, which is epsilon, and watch closely what's going to happen. Epsilon ABCD, EA wedge EB, wedge F plus CD, plus epsilon A wedge epsilon. Sorry, EA wedge EB. And this again is a function just of A plus. And this is a function just of A minus. And I'm not going to write the cosmological constant term for the moment. Well, epsilon times F plus is I times F plus. And epsilon times F minus is minus I times F minus. So this is I times the integral of EA wedge EB wedge F plus AB minus EA wedge EB wedge F minus AB. And I'm almost done, but let me notice something. F plus is, well, let me just, there's a little bit of tensorology I didn't say. Oops. Oh, it's too, okay. On the space of self-dual tensors, this splitting into two subspaces I can notate by a projection operator. So there's a projection operator P plus A, B, C, D, which is delta A, C, delta B, D, and these are all anti-symmetric objects, so I have to anti-symmetrize, okay, plus epsilon A, B, C, D, that is the object that takes the duality. Or I could take a minus sign here. And these are two projection operators. So P plus or minus squared is P plus or minus. And P plus times P minus is equal to 0. And P plus plus P minus is equal to 1, where what I mean by 1, so I've dropped some indices, but what I mean by 1 is delta AE delta BF anti-symmetrized with a factor of 2. Okay. And generally, if I have a tensor T, and I take the plus part, AB, what I really mean is that, sorry, AB upstairs say, that I took P plus ABCD, the projection operator, and applied it to the tensor CD. Okay, that's just making a little bit more explicit that we took this six-dimensional space of anti-symmetric tensors in four dimensions, and we split it into two three-dimensional subspaces, which are the self-dual and the anti-self-dual part. Well, so I can do that to E wedge E as well. So E wedge E is an object AB, and I can take its plus part, and I'm going to give that a name. I'm going to call that sigma AB, and plus or minus. I can do that to the plus parts and to the minus parts. So sigma AB plus are three two forms that live in this complexification of SO3, and sigma minus are three two forms. And the sigma pluses are self-dual, that is sigma plus dual is equal to plus I sigma, and the same thing with the minuses. So what I've done is built from the frame fields a self-dual two-form at every point, and an anti-self-dual two-form at every point. In fact, I've built three of each. Now, an interesting statement, this is when I said there's some beautiful geometry that I'm not going to go into, but I'll just state a beautiful result, which is that, so we already know that if I know the sigma pluses, they're complexified objects, so I can take their complex conjugate, I get the sigma minuses. So let me just think of the three sigma pluses. Those are three complex two forms, which are self-dual. So the claim is that if I know those, I know the metric mod conformal transformation. Does if I know the splitting of two forms, which is a six-dimensional space, into two three-dimensional subspaces, which are self-dual and anti-self-dual in this sense, that's the same thing, that's the same data as giving the metric mod conformal transformation. So it's giving the metric, it depends on the metric you can see because it's built from the frame fields, but it's an interesting, you know, it's a deeper result that this tells you about what the metric is, mod the conformal transformations. Basically what you're saying is, well, I'm just going to repeat it. Okay. I don't know. I don't know. I mean, my guess is it goes back to, I mean, Cartan, you know, Bile. I mean, they must have known this kind of stuff, but I don't know. Certainly, Flibanski knew it. Okay. We're about to come to what's called the Flibanski action. I'm looking for the eraser. There it is. Okay, so I was almost there. So therefore, because F plus is the projection operator applied to F, and F minus is the projection operator applied there, okay, I can also write this as I, the integral of sigma plus AB, where that's a, known to be a function of E, mod F plus AB minus the sigma minus AB okay, so the sigmas are functions of E, they're just quadratic in E. The F's are linear and quadratic in the A's. The F plus is linear and quadratic in three objects A plus, which you can think of as a complexified SU2 gauge field. And over here, the F minus is a function of their complex conjugates, which you can think of as also a complexified SO3 gauge field. Okay. Now, at some point, and if you, all I've done is rename things. So if you believe that the Palatini action gives the Einstein equation, you believe that varying this action gives the Einstein equation. On the other hand, there's a lot of redundant information there because the sigma minuses are the complex conjugates of the sigma plus and so forth. So at some point, somebody noticed that you don't need both of them in the variational principle. Now, if you have both of them, the action is a real function because it's something minus its complex conjugate times I. If I drop it, so in other words, the proposal is, so I think that's just notation. The proposal is to consider an action which is a complex action for the real Einstein equations which is of the form of the integral of EA wedge EB wedge FAB plus, which is an SU2 complex gauge field of A plus. And we can still the because we can put back in the cosmological constant term because of the projection operator structure, the cosmological constant term is just E wedge E plus Well, I don't actually, I don't need to be very fancy about this. There are various ways to use that to split this into two parts. I'm just going to keep it simple. If that's good enough. Okay, so that's the action we're interested in. Now, I'm going to make some claims to be checked, because I want to finish this by 10 o'clock. The claims are that the equations of motion for this, so let me start with the variation by A plus. And what you get from that is that the covariant derivative by the connection A plus, which is an SO3 connection, covariant derivative takes this object sigma plus to zero. And what that says is that the decomposition into who is in the plus sector and who is in the right sector of two forms is preserved by this S complex SO3 connection. And it's an argument that I won't give, but you can fill in, that this implies that AB plus is in fact the P plus projection operator applied to the object AB, which is a function of E, which we got in the full Palatini. So this is something to check. That is, under local Lorentz transformations, the three self-dual two forms in the plus sector rotate into themselves under the left-handed SO3 and don't change at all under the right-handed SO3. So therefore, the connection involved in rotating them is an SO3 connection that rotates them. And what this says is that that is the SO3 connection gotten by taking the plus part of the Lorentzian connection that preserves the metric compatible with E. Then one has the other Einstein equation, delta S, delta E, and that, as before, looks like epsilon A, B, C, D, EC wedge F plus, I'm sorry, EB wedge S plus CD, okay, plus lambda, and the, I'll just write it as the E cubed term, the term in the three E's. Now, that isn't yet the Einstein equations. But now we put in from here that this A plus is actually the plus part of the A, which is a function of E. This would be the Einstein equations if this were not F plus, but the whole F. So I can write this F plus as the whole F, plus, in the original definition, the dual of F. That's what F plus is F plus, there's a factor of I somewhere, isn't there? Plus I times the dual of F. On the other hand, epsilon A, B, C, D, E, B wedge the dual of F, C, D is equal to zero when that F is the curvature that is connected to the metric. This is the same as, if you go back, this is the same as R mu nu alpha beta totally anti-symmetric part on those three indices is equal to zero. But when A is the function of the connect of the frame field, then the total F is the R. So therefore, F plus on the solutions of the A equations of motion, okay, is nothing but the R plus its dual, but E wedge, its dual anti-symmetrized, is zero. That's a property of the R. So therefore, this is the Einstein equation. In other words, and not only that, they're real. That is, this is the term proportional to I. So we had a complex action. Therefore, the field equations have a real part and an imaginary part, but the imaginary part vanishes on the solutions. So this complex action has a variation principle which yields the Einstein equations. Now, let me emphasize one thing. I asserted that the metric is real, that is, that the E's are real. I could have dropped that. Nothing that I did required that the E's be real. And in some sense, it's more natural, given that everything that we now on the board have a complex action, complex curvatures, and so forth. So what we have most elegantly is an action principle for the complexified Einstein equations, that is, where the metric and the frame fields and the curvatures are complex valued, but it restricts down to the real Einstein equations. That is, the space of solutions of these equations allow me to pick the E's to be real, and they propagate the E's being real because they are just the Einstein equations. So if I pick initial data where the E's are complex, they propagate a complexification of the Einstein equations. But if I pick initial data where the E's are real, they propagate the real Einstein equations.
Where this is all classical.
Don't go there yet. Okay. I have one step. I'm still not done. But any questions?
Plus, because of your comment before, if we get just one part, then we get the metric act conformal transformation.
I didn't explain that. I definitely didn't explain it. I just asserted that.
Yeah, no, but some little bit confused now because. Now we're taking only a part of the action. Has it anything to do with what you said before?
No. I mean, this is, you might think, oh, cool, if I think about this, I can get an action principle for some conformal version of the Einstein equation. That only depends on the metric mod, the conformal transformation. And that's a hope that somehow has never been elegantly realized with these formulas. But so I just mentioned that as a fact in passing. Okay, I have this one more trick. I'm not done. By the way, what we've just done is not in Misnethor and Wheeler, and Wall is, in references to it, are in that review article that is in the page of readings. And it's also in Ashtakar has a book, I don't remember the title, but World Scientific. It's in Ravelli, etc. One more trick. This almost looks like BF theory. Except when I wrote the sigmas plus here, they're not just any two forms. They are the two forms made of the E's. Okay. But maybe I can lift that. That is, could I write an action which is starts off the integral of some, and let me now, the notation is getting ridiculous, because every time I write plus and two Lorentz indices, every time I write something like a plus ab, there's only three of them. So I'm going to write that from now on as a plus I, by which I mean a plus zero I, because I indicated before that's all you need. Okay, because they're really in an SU2, and they're really generating a complexification of SU2. Okay. So supposing, so I almost have this. This is a complexified SU2 DF theory. I don't have this because the field equations for this are F equals zero, because I need to know that the B's actually are really made from E's, so that each B is really quadratic in a fundamental thing. But what if I could invent some algebraic conditions that told me that the B's have to be made of frame fields? And this is what Plobansky did, and was forgotten and was rediscovered by Kaffer, Viadel, and Jacobson. It was done by Plobansky in something like 1970, actually earlier, I don't remember, 1967, 1968, and it was rediscovered in 1988. Consider the following objects, BI, wedge BJ, that's symmetric in I and J. So there are six of them. Now, this is a 3x3 symmetric tensor. This is a four form. So it's just every four form is proportional to every other form. Four form, it's symmetric in I and J because of the symmetry of four forms made of two forms. It's 6 degrees of freedom. Okay. Now, I tried to get the counting argument in 6 minutes that I have left. I'm going to screw up, so I'm just going to assert something. Let me consider the trace-free part of that. That means I subtract off 1/3 of the trace, which is delta ij,
bk, wedge bk. Okay. And let me set that equal to zero. That's five equations. Okay. Now I'm going to assert something, and it's also going to be a homework, especially since we have 5 minutes left. All the solutions, all B's that satisfy those five equations are of the form of there exists some frame fields, EA, such that B, I, as a two forms, as three two forms, are the self-dual parts of E wedge E. And what's easy to do, so I propose that you check this, what's easy to do is, so this is an if and only if, and it actually there's a plus or minus here. It's easy to plug this into here, crank through the definitions of whose self form. John, are you smiling because you've done this? Right, right. So that way is easy to plug in and show that you get zero. The only if part is an argument in linear algebra, which requires some insight into what's happening with these spaces of self-dual tensors and how the metric picks out who's self-dual and who's anti-self-dual. Okay. And if you want the arguments, I refer you to Kapadia, Del Jacobson. And these are papers in 1988, so unfortunately they're pre-archived. They're in classical and quantum gravity, and they're considered classic papers in the field, although after their papers were published, they got a note from Blavatsky in Mexico City pointing out that the whole thing was done in 1968 in his papers, which is sad because the Ashtekar formulation and everything that followed from it is a consequence of this and, you know, could have all developed 20 years earlier had anybody understood Blavatsky's paper. So the final statement is consider the following action, which is called the Blavatsky action. So now, by the way, notice that this is BF theory plus a quadratic equation for the Bs. So it's not very complicated. And the way to express it is to invent a Lagrange multiplier to enforce that. So the equation is B wedge F, which is just an SO3 connection. If I want to put back the cosmological, no, actually I'm going to do it the other. Yes, I'll do it this way. If you want to put back the cosmological constant, you put back the trace, BI wedge BI, and then you enforce these conditions with the Lagrange multiplier. So I'm going to invent a 3x3 matrix of fields phi and I'm going to enforce a condition that the trace of phi is zero. So that the variation of the action by phi gives me the five equations which are the trace-free part. Equivalently, the lambda is the trace of phi. With the condition that the trace of phi is fixed and is, it turns out, minus 3 lambda. I'm sorry, my chalk is acting up. So this is the Blavatsky action. Okay. And it is nothing but BF theory plus a quadratic condition, which is enforced by a Lagrange multiplier. Now, if you go through everything we said today, we've derived that. There were many things to check along the way, but we've derived that. And before stopping, I'm going to just write the equations of motion. And then next time, we'll get some insight to actually recognize them as the Einstein equations. And then we're going to do the Hamiltonian. We're going to go back and the tools we use for BF theory to get the Hamiltonian formulation and understand it, we're going to apply to this. So the equations of motion, if I vary A, I get as before, D wedge B is equal to zero. So the B are covariantly constant. If I vary the phi, I get that equation in the box up there, bi with bj minus 1/3 delta ij bk with bk is equal to 0. And if I vary the b's, I get now the two forms, the three two forms fi are equal to the matrix of five fields, phi ij, times bj. So these tell you that the B is really made of frame fields. These tell you that the connection is the connection in general relativity, which is metric compatible to the metric made of those frame fields. This then tells you that the three components of this SO3 Yang-Mills theory are linear combinations of the self-dual two forms made from the metric. And these five phis, okay, are nothing, it will take some while to convince you of that, but they're nothing but the Weyl curvature tensor. That is the five independent degrees of freedom of the gravitational field. If you've seen the decomposition of the Einstein equations in terms of Ricci, Weyl, et cetera. If you haven't, I'll discuss that next time. So this actually is nothing but the Einstein equations. And one can get a lot of insight by recognizing in that way. OK, we've done a lot tonight. Last few questions, and then we're done. Yeah?
So if I understand, from this action you get a reflectified space-time.
Yes.
And you impose some reality condition to pick out a real.
Yes. Or, yes, that's the story of the Lorentzian case. In the Euclidean case, everything is real, and one doesn't have to worry about that.
In the Lorentzian case,
yes.
Is it obvious that you get all solutions for real? I can sort of believe that you get all real analytic solutions, but I'm just worried about sort of smooth solutions to the real Einstein equations that are not analytic, which are the physically most interesting ones. Is it obvious that they come?
I think so. But
it's not obvious to me.
No. It's not obvious. And what one has, I mean, I understand the issue you're raising, so what one has to do is write the initial value problem, and then show that the initial value problem goes actually back to the initial value problem for Einstein equations, and which is actually what Ashtekar did in reverse. That is, Ashtekar originally took the initial value problem in what's called the ADM or Arnold-Desmond-Misner formulation, where the metric is real and its derivatives, time derivatives, are real, and transformed them into an initial value problem in terms of a complexified SU2 connection, and then showed that you could go back one to one when the reality conditions were imposed. And we will get the Ashtekar initial value formulation from finding the Hamiltonian formulation of this. So that completes the argument. And the stability of the real sector, that is, that if you impose completely, if you impose the reality conditions initially, it stays real, is a very important. If that were not true, then this would be uninteresting. And the issue of the reality condition at the quantum mechanical level, there's a long story about, which I'm not ready to talk about, but when we get to the quantum mechanics, there's a long story about it. And actually, because of that long story, these are not the only set of connection variables that people use. But let me get to that when I come to that. Okay. Other questions? Okay. Good. So we'll see you next week.
Thank you.